And for example, you know, Netflix published research a few years ago where even the choice of thumbnail on a content tile could drive click-through behavior.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Exceto Playback Podcast, the podcast discussing industry news, trends, and tech advancements in the OTT and streaming industry. I'm your host, Neil Van Zyl. Today, we'll be going back over the last decade of OTT and how things have changed and improved. Joining me today are two guests, Mrigesh Desai, Exceto's VP of North America. Mrigesh, good to have you back on. How are you?
I'm good, Neil. Good spending some time with you at CES and looking forward to this episode.
Likewise, it's a pleasure watching you when you're in your natural element. And also with us today is Lou Bolden, CEO of Bold New Solutions. Lou, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion going back over the last decade. Lots of change.
Absolutely. Before we get started, Lou, do you want to just give us a bit of an overview on Bold New Solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bold New Solutions is a business and technical consulting company that focuses on the media, entertainment, and telecommunication space. Our entire goal is to connect the service providers, anybody that's providing video services, with technology and solutions and people that help them drive their solutions forward faster and more economically. So that's really our goal, is really connecting companies like Exceto with the appropriate video service providers that are looking to move into the next generation and do it quickly and cost effectively in today's macroeconomic climate.
All right, so let's just jump right in. The two of you have been in the OTT space for quite some time, so I just want to pick your brains a little bit. So let's just start simple. Lou, how has the OTT space changed over the last 10 years?
Well, that's a great question. So if we were to go back 10 years ago, really OTT was an add-on to your traditional cable services, right? I mean, that's really what people thought of it. Like, the primary use for watching video 10 years ago was, while there was some VOD, it was primarily linear, some video on demand, and it was a companion device that went along with the traditional kind of cable viewing experience. And today, I think that's really, really flipped. You know, in the mainstream, while there are still cable services that are out there, OTT viewing and the OTT consumer experience has become the primary interface into entertainment, whether it's movies or linear or fast or even into any type of media, getting into what you're talking about with social media. So that's really the big shift that I've seen over the last 10 years. Although some of the technology is still the same, being able to do it at scale is really the big thing that's happened, in addition to the business model changes.
It's interesting, because I was kind of curious about how, obviously, the device platforms available over the last 10 years has really changed. But one thing that's been really surprising to me is just how well Roku has managed to continue doing. Even though there's all these other big players in the market, Roku still manages to maintain top market share. Mrigesh, what are you thinking? What are they doing that's letting them stay ahead? And what are they doing that's hopefully going to keep them ahead or allow them to stay in this position?
Yeah, great question. So I think, yeah, before I address the Roku question, 10 years ago, I think there was a general theory that there would be market consolidation when it came to the different device platforms. And almost the opposite has played out, right? So the fragmentation is richer than ever. You've got device platforms popping up even in this day and age, I think, when you look back at how Roku started out, having their own OS platform, having their own device lineup, and really focusing on sort of the low end side of the market, devices that were more sort of cost effective for consumers. I think that's how their success was born, but I think how their success has continued to maintain has been their undeniable focus on just having the best possible content on their platforms, ensuring that they even have their own content service on their platform. They're one of the early pioneers and introduced the Roku FAST service several years ago. I think obviously they've been more successful in the United States, but several years ago, they did decide to start focusing on international markets and have certainly made inroads in markets like Canada and elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, I think huge kudos to them and other smaller, if you want to call it that, platforms who are punching well above their weight and competing with the likes of Apple and Amazon and Google and others.
Yeah, they've also done pretty well in Brazil and the UK region. It's funny because I think we have another OS coming into the market now with Titan OS in Europe. So there's no sign of slowing down or I guess amalgamation. Lou, so one of the things that Roku had done well is they've had this AVOD focus. So we've seen this turn now back to ad supported. What do you think caused that shift, and how has it changed from the original start of OTT where it was largely subscription based?
Yeah, well, I think the one ad-supported television, you know, first of all, it's been around forever. It never really went away in any way, shape, or form. But what happened is I believe people just had too much choice, right? There was too much choice. It wasn't easy to find content because you had so many players, similar to what's happening with the platforms being out there and bringing content together. It became difficult, not only because you had Disney and Apple and Max and all the different, you know, potential places to get content, but you had to kind of context switch from one platform to another, and you started not getting that lean back kind of, oh, that's nice, that just got put in front of me again, and I like that. And so it gave you the ability with moving to FAST and AVOD, really kind of that discovery that we started seeing in social media. And so that's where I see this, you know, kind of coming back full circle, and it becomes a much more, you know, kind of cost effective and affordable, especially for the younger generation, where then you can choose your favorite platforms and engage with them. So I think it's a combination of one, much higher cost, very fragmented to find the content you want, but then also to drive into something that gets a bit more curated for you when you're thinking about what people are doing with both FAST and AVOD channels. They're curated channels. This is where your interest lies.
Yeah, expanding the focus more onto discoverability again. Murgesh, let's talk a little bit about UX. What changes have you noticed with regards to UX in the last 10 years?
Yeah, that's a question that I think probably deserves its own podcast episode. But you know, if I were to give you the highlights, you know, firstly, I think the maturity in terms of appreciating how much of an impact UX has on audiences has greatly improved. I think there were early projects we took on a decade ago where, you know, even a tier one broadcaster, without naming names, would sort of say, hey, you know, we just want something that emulates Netflix, right? But yeah, I mean, maybe they're much more of a sports content focus. So I think that sophistication in UX thinking wasn't as commonplace back then, and of course there was a bit of a, you know, rush to market approach back then as well. So folks took a lot of shortcuts with just getting services out there that may not have had the best UX optimization. A decade later, and I think the thinking around user experience tailoring app experiences according to demographic, type of content, device form factors, that's all improved significantly. So today when we take on projects, you know, it's very commonplace that design is actually at the forefront of thinking when it comes to putting the grassroots around several projects. And also what's become more commonplace is folks are now thinking about user experience first and foremost, and then building the backend tech stack around that. A decade ago, it was very much the opposite. Folks would make, you know, infrastructure and video workflow decisions, and then the last mile, if you will, was user experience. And it's like, hey, we've made all these very fundamental decisions around the tech stack, and you know, can you implement a user experience that will work with that? You know, that change has been, I think, very helpful for the industry at large, because it really should be, you know, users and their expectations and performance of the OTT streaming services that should drive the entire technology stack.
Well, you know, one of the other things that I've seen recently, and I think Aceto's done a pretty darn good job of it, is that the form factor of the devices that you're using to control the user experience has changed. If you go back, we were talking about in the last 10 years, you had a remote that had many, many, many buttons. right? You were able to input channel numbers. And now the remotes that are primarily being used, if you see, whether you're talking about a Roku device or you're talking about a smart TV, they have very, very simple navigation. So then you have to tie into that user experience, how you actually interact with the user experience to still enable people to get to the content they want to watch quickly, but to be something that's seamless with any type of remote. And that's a really, you know, really, again, as Rajesh was saying, taking that user experience first beyond just what you're seeing on the screen, but how they're interacting with that, whether it's with a remote or on a mobile device where you're talking, going from four or five tiles to two tiles and, you know, up, down, swiping, left, right, what have you. And that has to be very, very well thought out to get the biggest engagement that you're having, especially when you move to advertising driven, you know, type of content, because the more they watch, the more money you make, the happier your consumers are.
And just to add one more thought. So, you know, I think in the early days, there was obviously not a lot of user behavioral analytics. It was very hard to actually understand how these streaming services were performing and what aspects of the user experience their consumers actually enjoyed. Obviously, with the telemetry that's being implemented in these experiences, there is a lot more data, a lot more ability to iterate on the user experience based on that data. And for example, you know, Netflix published research a few years ago where even the choice of thumbnail on a content tile could drive click-through behavior. Where you place content on a given screen could drive click-through behavior. The expected user experience paradigm when you're using, you know, an Apple TV versus a Roku versus a smart TV could drive click-through behavior. So all of the sort of insights that are now available to these different streaming services is helping them iterate a lot faster with user experience. So I think that's been a great advancement in the industry as well.
Let's focus on something that hasn't changed. Lou, has there been anything that's been consistent through the 10 years?
Well, you know, it's an old saying, but content is king. It's still the driver for everything, you know, in our particular industry. And so if you have good content, people are going to come and watch it. Now, the economics around it might be a little bit different, but the content is still king. Now, those who are successful are able to shift with their business models and also make sure that the content gets in front of them in many, many different forms, whether it's in a traditional, you know, SVOD, an AVOD, a FAST, or even being able to move that content over into, you know, your social media type of engagement so that you can give them clips and then bring them back into that main viewing experience for them. So I think that's probably the number one thing that's stayed the same. And then secondarily, you have to think about what type of experience you're doing. Is this a lean-in experience where it's just you and how you're engaging? Or is it a lean-back experience where we say maybe it's sports and you're sharing with other people? So those are things that you have to think about and have really stayed the same throughout the years going, you know, back to home video, those type of things. People still want to engage with other people, right? It's not just a singular individual experience when it comes to television and movies.
Rajesh, anything to add?
No, that, you know, what Lou says certainly holds true for me as well. So I think, yeah, the why around these services hasn't changed, as Lou says, right? People just want to enjoy the best possible content, be entertained. But I think the how has definitely changed, right? So there's a lot more content verticals in a sense, right? So there's verticals associated with sports, with fitness content, with lifestyle content, with education, with edutainment. I think you've seen an upsurge in sort of new media content, which is exciting. And then another reason, another way the how has changed has just been in like, how can I consume this content? So again, we talk about the device fragmentation, and there's been all types of, you know, devices, both lean-in experiences and lean-back experiences that facilitate that. But with the advent of extended reality, you know, that's just a whole new how in terms of consuming these experiences.
You know, you hit a good point. I think the consumer expectation has changed dramatically. One, in terms of time to finding content, I think it's become more and more important that our patience level to sit and scroll through you know, it used to be 300 channels to find something you wanted, or maybe you had your five channels, or scroll left and right and up and down in an SVOD service. You know, are the consumers, you know, willingness to spend a significant amount of time searching for content has dramatically reduced, because, you know, some other services that aren't primarily video services are doing a great job of putting content in your social media feed in front of you that you're interested in. And you may not even know that it's an ad or it's entertainment content. So those are things that we need to think about on the, you know, kind of traditional video, you know, distribution and what our consumers' expectations are. Again, thinking like Yogesh was saying earlier, starting with the consumer in mind, that end user in mind, will really help us, you know, build better systems and really drive, you know, viewership and continued engagement going forward.
We talk about how user expectations have changed over the last little while. One of the last bastions of linear TV is probably sports. But even now we're seeing that is slowly coming to OTT. Yogesh, what are you seeing with regards to sports UX experiences on these device platforms? Or what are people looking for? What do people want?
Yeah, I think this is an area of the content universe that is so exciting. The technology has evolved at such a pace that the use cases that will be available for consumers are just, yeah, very, very exciting. So, you know, coming back again to extended reality, you know, I think the idea of bringing the in-venue experience to your home, or even enhancing the in-venue experience when you're there, becomes, sort of an area that companies like ourselves and others can deliver, you know, very fantastic user experiences for. So I think for sports viewing audiences specifically, who care about obviously the broadcast and live content, but also all the ancillary things that come with sports, whether it's stats and scores and scheduling, all of that is, you know, better enabled in a sense by 6 degrees of freedom and having XR experiences. In addition to that, you know, to what Lou said earlier about people wanting to experience content with other people, yeah, with sports, you know, the fan experience is only exciting if you're sharing it with other fans. So even things like social watching, for example, you know, those are areas that with OTT streaming platforms and extended reality, those use cases are much better enabled than what was possible several years ago in a more traditional TV format. So, I'm just very excited about it. And, you know, if you look at the next couple of years, right, LA in 2026 will be host of the World Cup final. LA in 2028 will be host of the Olympics. The Vision Pro has just launched, and I'm sure the adoption of not just that platform, but other XR platforms will start skyrocketing. So the experiences for some of these very marquee events that are coming up in future years, I think will really transform consumer psyche around extended reality. You've got to marry the technological capabilities with just the best possible content out there. And, you know, nothing like experiencing the World Cup final through VR or the Olympics through VR that I think will really transform how consumers think about these devices as entertainment devices.
I couldn't agree more with what can be done with sports, especially those type of sports that have little breaks in them, right? I would think about football and the ability that you've got a 6 second play and then you've got 30 seconds of quiet or non-action. So from a fan standpoint, one, you can interact with other people, you can talk mess, you can have a little fun, but you can also then start rotating your view and look at that from a, you know, not being there or even being in the venue and say, oh, I didn't see this play from this angle. And you can even start to have those types of views and discussions, maybe even at the same time that they're going back up to the replay booth, since we're in the Super Bowl season. Those would be really, really great experiences to be able to have a dialogue, a discourse, a discussion, an argument with your friends kind of in real time, whether it's, you know, actually speaking to them when you're not at the event or in a chat.
Speaking of football, Lou, I just want to say congratulations for the number one pick on the Bears. I think you guys have great opportunities ahead of you, whether you trade it down or you take a QB. It's very exciting.
Well, hopefully we actually get it done this time, and we can make some good choices. We have a long history of having great picks and not doing a lot with it. So we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
I know you're both obviously huge football fans. You know, I got to ask your predictions for the upcoming Super Bowl, Neil.
I'm a big believer in Mr. Irrelevant. I think Brock Purdy's got it, but I don't know. It's every time I bet against Mahomes, it never works out. So I think I got to still support the Niners, but it's going to be close.
Now, I'm going to bet on the defense, not on Mahomes. I'm going to bet on the defense of the Kansas City Chiefs. They have just been really dominant, something like 17 points a game, even with the, you know, probably the MVP, maybe should be Lamar Jackson, shut him down, running, passing, everything. I'm actually going to go with Mahomes, but I'm going to go with the Kansas City Chiefs defense.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have a great run defense until they needed it in the conference finals. They just absolutely stopped everything that Baltimore was throwing at them. Unbelievable. But really exciting. So it'll be a good game. Looking forward to it.
Who do you think, Muguez?
I think I'm leaning towards Kansas City. And I mean, I don't know if the Taylor Swift effect is real or not, but she seems to be providing them a little bit of good luck these days. So let's see.
Kelsey's been playing really well. He has. So let's go over a little bit more back to content acquisition. We've seen that Amazon and Diamond Sports have kind of worked out a deal, and now we've seen Netflix and WWE working together. Is it just going to be a lot more of these partnerships between leagues and major tech companies, or are either of you seeing anything different?
I think there's definitely somewhat of a trend here. In fact, a few months ago, I sort of blogged about what Netflix were starting to do in the live event realm, right? So, and I think they're actually doing it in the right way, right? So, you know, they had a small time event that they broadcasted on Netflix. It was a Chris Rock special. Then the next thing they came out with several months later was a live event that I think pitted Drive to Survive stars, so Formula One stars, with a few golfers in a fun event. So nothing high stakes. And now they're going to be building up towards, you know, streaming WWE Raw starting January 2025. So, and of course, Amazon and Apple have their own sports rights deals. So I think this consolidation and you know, major streaming players bringing on more sports content onto their platforms is going to be a continuous trend. It's an expensive game. It's a complicated game. And of course, you know, where you have more of a regional footprint really matters in terms of audience penetration. So it's a tough one to crack. But I do think, you know, we're going to continue to see streaming services who have sort of a multi-continent approach continuing to bring on more and more live sports.
I agree. I think a big part of that, though, was the realization that to bring people to your platform, you needed to have something that they were truly, truly passionate about. But that wasn't just a cost center. So if you look at what, you know, what really happens with these from a monetary standpoint, well, Muguez, you're absolutely right. They're expensive as all get out. The additional revenue generated from advertising, viewer engagement, and loyalty is just massive. And so Prime Video is completely different than Netflix because their model has so many different facets to it. But if you're getting people to engage in Prime Video because they're going to be there Thursday night, they're still coming into a page that has an opportunity to not only do the advertisements, that's with any type of linear sports event, but also it's bringing them into that platform where people buy stuff and they can go right from watching stuff to buying stuff, right? So that makes sense for Amazon. And for Netflix, though, I mean, when they embraced moving to ad supported anything and those different tiers, this is a natural evolution. And anybody that has those type of viewership, that amount of viewership, if they're not taking advantage of those viewers and ads, then they're making some interesting mistakes from a business perspective. Now at the same time, they have to make all of those different shifts into one, how they're engaging the consumers, what the user interface looks like. You know, that entire paradigm really changes when you go from a SVOD to a live linear type of deployment and how you deal with real time streaming versus, you know, SVOD, where it's, you know, you can cache enough and this has to be good and on all the time, especially if you're going to do something in 4K. You know, those are the challenges, but I think they're you're going to see that more and more.
Speaking a little bit more about just this opportunity to include advertising into your experiences and just in sports in general, one of the, I guess, big advancements over the last 10 years from linear to OTT opportunities to advertising, of course, is contextual advertising, dynamic advertising, and a lot of the really interesting use cases we're seeing now where you are even getting computer vision involved, where you can real-time implement ads into the game that are dynamic custom for the user watching. So there's some really interesting stuff there. Is that the way to get mass market penetration, or are those more niche cases? Do you think we're still just going to stick with standard pre-rolls, mid-rolls for the next little bit? I'll leave this open to both of you, but I'll ask Lou first, and then we'll come to Muguez.
the pre-rolls, mid-rolls, those are going to be part of it because they're easy and to the masses of everybody that you're trying to advertise to. But if you want to reduce wastage, right, or if you want to increase reach, you're going to have to get really into the programmatic and targeted types of advertising. Even like soccer, they were, I guess, the pioneer, soccer and hockey, the pioneers of being able to paste anything over on the boards or what have you. And in fact, I actually saw something, I was watching TV yesterday with a buddy of mine, and they placed the Fruity Pebbles banner on the Nets court. And we had this argument about, did they paint the net court? And I was like, absolutely not. They didn't paste it. I don't know why Fruity Pebbles came up on there from an advertising standpoint, but I think that's going to happen more and more as the analytics and the data that's coming back from who's doing, then you can really target those and make them interactive and make them relevant to the consumer that's watching that, just then driving up more and more money and more revenue. And companies like Aceto can help make it happen.
Yeah, and what I'd add to that is I think also for direct merchandising, there's a lot of opportunities where contextual data around the user is going to be very beneficial, right? So, you know, if I had to bring up the VR experiences again, you know, imagine being able to have an experience where, you know, your favorite team with your favorite player and their jersey is being highlighted to you as something you should purchase, right? Being able to interact with merchandise, purchase that merchandise in a contextual setting in a VR environment, I think changes the game, you know, in a very, very different way. I think both contextual ads and contextual merchandising are going to be very, very important for just getting the most out of these sports rights that you're purchasing, right? I mean, you can't just rely on direct-to-consumer revenues and sort of ad-supported revenues. Your ad partners and your merchandising are going to be sources of revenues that you need to really tap into to make the business case really work.
Absolutely. There's no reason that we can't have the same type of CPMs that are in the digital world on the video space, right? We have the data now. We can push the ads in the appropriate time as well. So it's a big shift for the business. It's a big shift for technology, but it's there. I mean, if the social media platforms are doing it and they're all video based, we can move it over to this side as well.
Awesome. All right. Before we wrap up here, I just want to give you two both a chance to talk about anything else. Or is there, I guess, what are you most excited looking forward to? Let's end it there. So, Lou, what are you looking forward to the most here in the industry?
I would say probably old is new. A little bit on what Ragesh is saying, but I think that, you know, there are a number of tried and true business models and engagement models that we kind of lost sight of, you know, for the consumers. And I think fast and advertising driven video consumption is going to come back and be bigger than ever. While there's still going to be a place to purchase and have a subscription to services, I think that is where we're going to see just a lot more engagement. And that's actually going to tie in with what Ragesh was saying about AI and ML, because then you're going to be pushing people into things that are really relevant for them. And what will end up is that whether it's a piece of content that's for enjoyment or an ad, that's where we're going to see all of these things come together.
If I were to add to the old is new mantra or statement that Lou just made, I think from a personal perspective, you know, I've known Lou for almost a decade, and the industry has been evolving a lot from a technology perspective, but I think on the technology side there's still, you know, a few players that seem to be staying relevant, and we seem to be working with a lot of the same people we worked with 10 years ago, and it's great to see how they're advancing, great to see how we've been partnering with them to solve customer use cases, sort of building upon those relationships, strategizing together, brainstorming together. I think it takes companies like Aceto and BNS really coming together to help champion innovation and change with several of our customers. So yeah, we might be dinosaurs by this point, but I think it's, you know, a couple of dinosaurs who can still help innovate and create change within the organizations we support.
Awesome, you too. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was a great convo.
Yeah, thanks, Neil.
Thanks Neil. Cheers, guys. Take it easy.
Cheers.
Have a good one.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, that's all for the podcast. If you're interested in learning a little bit more about Bold New Solutions, feel free to click the link in the description of this episode. Thank you to both Ragesh and Lou for facilitating that awesome conversation. If you're interested in reaching out to us to ask a question or suggest a topic, or just want to talk about something in the industry, feel free to send us an email at playback.podcast@axedo.tv or reach out to me on LinkedIn. That's all. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.